Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I'm joined today by Alex Chalakian. Alex is the CEO and founder of Lake Avenue Financial and was recently named one of the top 10 financial advisors in the country by Investopedia. Additionally, he is the CEO and founder of FutureVest, a financial literacy startup. He's here today. We're going to talk about the future of finance, the future of advice, and all about financial literacy. Welcome.
Hey, Daniel. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, it is great to be here in beautiful Southern California. It's hot today, but not as hot as it is in the rest of the country, so we'll take it. We're going to jump right in. You have been in the industry for decades, and you've had a ton of success. But lately, you've parlayed that into your most recent endeavor, which is FutureVest, this financial literacy startup. Tell us about what it is and the need you saw in the financial literacy space.
So FutureVest is an online well-being platform that I had thought about creating back in 2018, actually. It's something where I felt like there was a need for people to be more educated, for them to learn about what's going on. I just noticed around me a lot of individuals, young individuals, that were being taught the wrong things. But unfortunately, it got shelved for a little bit just based on my crazy work schedule. We were working on some M&A deals on the Lake Avenue Financial side. We were also running around like you, speaking at different conferences and so forth. So it got shelved. But once COVID hit and the pandemic and we were all kind of locked up in our homes, it gave me a chance to bring the idea back and work on it. And the beauty of this is just something that we've been working with my family. So I kind of gathered everyone. I said, hey, kids, Rosa, my wife, and let's work on this. And we started putting it together, started figuring out the technology, started talking to different vendors, building it out, working on a library and so forth. So it's been fantastic. And the beauty of this is just to try to help as many people as possible. You know, part of the mission that we have is, since it is a subscription platform, for every paid user, we're going to give a membership away for free so that those that in the underserved community can get access to the same tools.
Yeah, perfect. So here's where I have to be the bad guy, right?
You the bad guy?
No, me, never. The bad guy. So I have been plain spoken about the fact that I don't think that financial literacy is the panacea that some folks think it is. And when you tell them this, it's like telling people that you hate Santa Claus or something. Like nobody wants to hear, like, this guy doesn't believe in financial literacy. So let me put some nuance around those remarks. It's not that I don't believe in it. I actually think it's foundational, but I think it's necessary but not sufficient. You know, we know that we forget about 90% of what we learn in the first 3 days if there's not this application. We know there's this profound knowing-doing gap, right? There's this huge gap between knowing the right thing to do and actually doing the right thing. There was actually research done by the Department of the Treasury in 2002 that showed that people who went through financial literacy programs were better about saving and better about prepping for retirement. But there's more recent research by Mandel and Klein that showed no correlation between literacy and subsequent financial behavior. So I'll shut up now with my fun hating. But you know, I know you're a big behavioral finance enthusiast. That's how we sort of connected.
Right.
Knowing what we know about human behavior, what does effective financial literacy really look like?
You know, you have a very good point with all the things that you mentioned and the studies, and we look at a lot of the stats and so forth. There's definitely a need. But as humans, we always fall back on our behaviors, right? And if we're not taught the right behaviors and the right habits, it's very easy to go back to those old habits. So I think we have to, A, empower individuals with the right tools. A lot of them do not have access to those tools, being the fact that they might not be able to know, A, what's available to them, and B, just not having access because they either don't have enough money, or typical advisors are going to say you don't qualify for us to help you with advice. And then unfortunately, a lot of times they get advice that's garbage that's out there, whether it be through social media or other platforms where some people don't necessarily give them the best information. So empowering them with the right tools. And then helping them, like I mentioned, create the right money habits. We all know that that's very powerful, very helpful. But on top of that, just even if I teach you, Daniel, what those habits are, you need a coach. You need someone to guide you and hold you accountable. And that's part of what we develop with FutureVest. It's like, okay, great. I can share all these blog posts and literature and here's some great calculators and tools, but someone's got to show you how to use them. And then someone's got to help you in wanting to stay on track. And I kind of, the way I looked at it was the same way as when you look at the gym, right? I can give you all these weights and all the gym machine and equipment, but A, if you don't know how to use them or use them properly, you can hurt yourself,
Yeah. Right?
We see that with advice. And then B, someone there, if you have someone like a trainer that can show you like, okay, Alex, you're doing this right, or I'm gonna keep track. We're gonna track your weight loss, or we're gonna track based on whatever your goals are. If you want to get, abs, or you want to have a bigger upper body, or your legs, or whatever it is. So having that coaching is what's important. Now, this is not something new. We talk about this as financial advisors, but the difference being most people are not going to quote unquote qualify to work for an advisor, or most advisors have asset minimums or whatever it is. So having a platform that can allow you to give this information efficiently and on a scalable front is kind of what was behind FutureVest. And I think that's what will allow us to be able to do it. So hopefully we make a dent in this and push things in the right direction, but definitely, it's something to think about as we're building out the platform.
So one of the models that I kind of work with is one that I've developed that I call my three E's. And if you think about the base of a pyramid, right? The base of that pyramid is education. Without education, you're nothing. And so that's where I think the financial literacy piece is so powerful. The second piece of that is environment, right? Like having the right tools and technology and the right portfolio mix, mm-hmm, candidly. Mm-hmm. And then the top piece is that encouragement, that hand-holding, the coaching, the value of advice sort of thing. So I want to talk about that middle E, though, for a moment, that environmental piece, because there's been some interesting research in behavioral finance, behavioral economics recently that sort of questioned the nudging culture. The book Nudge by Thaler and Sunstein was mm-hmm. so well received and so powerful. But there's been a recent critique of it that it focused on the micro rather than the macro. So we've tried to do things with behavioral economics, like get more people to use reusable straws, right? To help save the earth. And yet we know that 70% of all environmental pollutants are created by 100 companies.
Right.
So you and I can, wash metal straws out all day till we're blue in the face. But ultimately, more harm is being done at sort of the macro level. And I think about that, in the fintech world. We are out here, people like you and I are out here trying to, preach the gospel of financial literacy. And at the same time, we have big billion-dollar tech companies that are trying to induce the worst behaviors
right.
out of people
right.
and are really monetizing people's worst financial behaviors. How much do we need to do to kind of take this message to the institutions? And do we even have any hope, trying to arm individuals with financial literacy when they're going to be operating in an environment that's so damaging?
Yeah, well, we saw a lot of this kind of transpire with the Robin Hoods of the world. And again, going back to behavioral aspect, I just think about the fact that during the pandemic, we saw people didn't have sports, didn't have their regular life, and didn't have all the things that they were used to doing. And some of them that used to be able to gamble on certain things, now they're like, oh, guess what? The stock market is still open. So it's like a casino, an online casino. So yes, these companies at the end of the day want to drive dollars for their stockholders, right? So that's what the incentive is for some of these types of companies. But when we look at fintech companies and others, I see where a lot of them are developing the right things, and they're working with behavioral individuals like yourself and others and friends of ours. But that is still not enough. I think we gotta encourage the good behavior at the individual level, right, and teach them those habits, as well as advocate for the systemic change around what's going on. You know, if we talk about what they're doing with financial literacy being in schools and enforcing that now amongst kids, high schoolers and so forth, that's on a big macro scale. But we need to still be able to give them access and education on the micro scale. But and then going full circle there, the companies that are involved need to have, you know, again, they need to have a reason why they want to do this. If advisors realize that that's what they need to put in front of their clients, mm-hmm. guess what? There's going to be that demand, and these tech companies are going to want to build those types of products. If advisors don't really want that and they're like, oh, my clients want a better A, B, or C, the tech companies are going to build towards that. So they're listening to the advisor. So I think it comes back on our shoulders as well to be able to get in front of the tech companies and be on their advisory board or involved in some way and say, this is what our clients are looking for. Mm-hmm. And so we want to be able to offer that solution.
You know, one of the types of knowledge that I think isn't discussed as much is meta-knowledge, which is almost like knowing what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I use the example of myself and cars. Like, I don't know anything about cars. I just want to know enough about cars to not get ripped off when I go to the dealership, right? Like, I'm never going to be able to fix my own car. I'm never going to be able to take care of it myself, just the way that most people will never, you know to manage their portfolios. But I think that most people need enough financial literacy that they can thoughtfully select a tech provider, right? And know when one tech provider is preying on their worst impulses,
right,
or not,
right?
Or to thoughtfully select a financial advisor. So that to me is almost that first layer of financial education is knowing what you don't know, or knowing just enough to make good decisions about how to outsource.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the other things we saw happen is with, again, I'm not picking on Robinhood, but a lot of other solutions like this that came out, it was so novel, and it was something that a lot of younger individuals said, this is so easy. I could just get on my phone, download an app, and boom, I can buy stocks or whatever it is, or I can trade options or something they didn't even know what the heck they were doing with. But on the flip side, we have the dinosaur companies as well in finance, traditional finance, where they have never had to necessarily make any changes or moves because it hasn't been asked from them. And even if it has, it's easier to say, yeah, why are we going to spend $100 million on R&D and try to build this out when we could just lose you as a client and we're good. So I think it needs a mix. We need to find a somewhere in the middle where we can have a larger fintech companies that say, look, there's a need for this. We don't need to create an online casino, but we need to make things a little bit more user-friendly for our advisors, for their clients, the next generation to want to come in here and want to learn. And that's kind of where I see, if you look at something like Duolingo, which I just downloaded just so I could learn a little bit more Spanish. I was like, why don't they have a financial version of this? This is so freaking easy. Like, it just walks you through it and you learn and you go at your own pace and there's a gamification to it and so on and so forth. So as we're building out FutureVest, we kind of think about all that stuff, but we're just one little company. You know, we're talking about these tech titans that they can move the needle a lot quicker than we can.
So Duolingo, I think, is the perfect example. It's the one that I use. Duolingo took over my wife's soul. Like, she became so hell-bent on not breaking her streak. And she's doing French. And, like, I would find her doing it, like, in the closet while she's getting dressed. And I hear her speaking French, and I'm like,
I was doing this yesterday.
What is going on?
I lowered the volume so I don't, like, wake Rosa up because I didn't want to break the streak, right?
Yeah.
So these are the habits that I'm talking about. And that's one of the other things, too. During the pandemic, we purchased Tonal, which is an exercise equipment, right? And you got on there. And right now I have a 67-week streak. And it's like it or not, I'm going to work out because I don't know why. I just don't want to break that streak because it's been so far. You're like, you can't do it. It's almost like a, you know, when you're on a batting streak, you're like, oh, you can't break it. And then you start being superstitious. I got to wear this hat and I got to, I wore this sock last time and blah, blah, blah. But these are the things we need to be able to instill. And unless the technology companies and the fintech companies are willing to evolve and build this stuff, it's going to be very hard.
Well, and you know, it's a great point. I think to this point, a lot of what fintech has done, at least the most popular fintechs, has gamified our worst impulses.
Oh,
but I think Duolingo is a great example of how you can take a human tendency to get, you know, possessive about not breaking a streak and use it toward a positive end. So I hope we'll see more.
You're learning something good, not bad habits, where you're like, okay, great, I just lost every single cent I have.
Yeah. So this next question is, you know, obviously no disrespect. You've had an enormous amount of success. You were just named to this top 10 list. But if you had to do it all over again, you've done a ton right, but if you had to do it all over again with 2 decades of experience now, what would you do differently as an advisor? How, for the advisors listening to this that are starting out today, what can they learn from you?
Yeah, I've done a lot of things right, but I've done a tremendous amount of things wrong as well throughout my career. And this will be the 25th year in the industry. So I've experienced a lot. But if I go back in my day, you know, in 97, the industry was more prone to, we have the information, you need the information type of thing. So there was kind of that standard of why clients needed us. And with the internet and with all these other tools and stuff we're talking about, there's a lot of clients that don't need us. And you know, frankly, I love the fact that there's a lot of do-it-yourselfers as long as they're hopefully doing the right things. And that's a way for them to learn. So I would, if I had to start my firm today, and I do this checkup on myself every year, right now we're rebranding everything. We're changing, we're undoing everything. And you know, to Rose's dismay, she's like, why are you always changing stuff? I'm like, babe, you don't get it. Like, we need to kind of be on the forefront of this and wanting to look at what's happening. Because if I just stay stuck in our ways, even though we can say, oh, it's worked well so far, someone's going to leapfrog us or things are going to change. So if I were to launch a firm today, I would take a lot of things out of the mix. You know, again, back in the days, we were focusing a lot more on asset management, of giving that a level of like, oh, our portfolio is going to beat your portfolio, or here's the top 10 funds we recommend and look how they've outperformed the mutual funds you own. So throw that stuff out the window. I don't think you really need to worry about it. I do practice active management as well as passive management in our firm. So I think there's a place for both. But if someone were to start, I wouldn't come in saying, okay, we need to focus on building portfolios and models and do that stuff. You can use a lot of different vendors for that. I think the focus needs to be on advice. And you need to, you've probably heard this a million times, have some sort of a niche that you are focusing on, because or else you're gonna get lost in the sea of sameness amongst other advisors and find out why they would work with you. And I've had this conversation with a number of my colleagues of saying, hey, go to your website, take a look at it. What do you see? And I've done this. I was actually just doing this as we were rebranding our own website. Is when I go to advisors' website, and someone in the industry, I'm like, this is just garbage. There's just so much stuff. But if I was someone that wasn't in the industry, I wouldn't understand half or 70% of the stuff on here. It's just too confusing. Get to the point. Show them what you can help them with. Give them free information. Try to get them on there, and then you can work with them and give them positive advice. And focus more on the advice aspect, not the asset management aspect. That's another thing. Obviously, coming from where we were, a big part of our practice is on managing assets and charging fees for it. There's nothing wrong with that. But we're slowly but surely transitioning and adding more financial planning types of fees in our practice. So it's a lot of little tweaks. And I think one of the things for us is to make sure that we keep track of the technologies out there. Now, will we use them? Maybe, maybe not. But we want, at least want to keep track of what's happening and try to evolve. And not just kind of stick to like, oh, we still look like the company from 97. No, yeah. we look nothing like it. But for newer advisors coming in, it's so hard. They I would not want to start in this business today just knowing what I know. It's a lot more difficult. There's robos and other things that you can or cannot compete with, but you need to have a reason why a client would want to work with you.
So what everybody knows, you need a niche, right? And yet I have come across so few niches that I feel are truly differentiated. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's hard. Like there is whatever, 300 plus thousand advisors in the country. And let's be honest, most of them do more or less the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's real reasonable. They diversify, they create plans. What is your niche? Like, what is your niche? How do you separate yourself from your 300,000 peers?
Well, it's interesting. So we didn't necessarily, when I started, I was 21 years old. It's not like I said, oh, I'm going to start my planning practice and this is my niche. It kind of came to us as we realized a bigger and bigger percentage of our clients fell into a specific niche. And more importantly, I realized those are the individuals I love working with. Mm. I really enjoy it. And so we work very closely with financially independent women, those that are going through different life changes, transitions, whether it be their spouse passed away or they're going through a divorce, as well as a lot of top level single executives. You know, they're not in a relationship, but they want to know that they don't have to rely on anyone else. They want to be financially independent. So that is our niche. Unfortunately, we didn't do a very good job. If you went to our website, lakeavenuefinancial.com, like you would not see that there, because a part of me as an advisor, and this is one of the mistakes I made, was just like, well, what if we lose so-and-so client? Or what if someone comes to our website and they realize that we might not work with them? So I realized that was a mistake and we should have changed this a long time ago. We have clients, every type of client, but that's something that we're passionate about and working with, and I would say is my specialty. So we want to make sure that we could put that out there.
It's an interesting conversation. When I started, I was on my own for about 10 years before I joined Brinker Capital and then later Orion. In that 10 years, I started out as sort of general business psychology. And so I was doing everything from pre-employment assessment of executive talent to leadership development and organizational behavior. And in that process, I started working with a number of financial firms and thought, well, like, whoa, this is the most interesting work I'm doing, right? Mm-hmm. These are the smartest people. The pay is good. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
The pay is good. These are smart folks. And the market is this fascinating backdrop against which I can ply my trade, right? Like the market gives you real-time sentiment and sort of emotional measures. And so I started off as a generalist, but my career took off when I specialized. And it took me a long time to get there because I struggled with the same thing you did, which is, I said, I'm going to leave a piece of business on the table. Like if I'm the behavioral finance guy, what if someone wants to pay me, whatever, to do a pre-employment assessment and I'm not that guy? And it was only when I took that leap that my career really took off.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're dealing with some of the stuff in the family too, where if there's health issues, like with our parents, you're constantly looking for a specialist, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're not like, oh, let me find a generalist. That's easy. That's not a problem. But now you need a specialist for this and a specialist for that and blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, this is when people look those people up. That's when you actually go online and look for someone with that specialty. You're not traditionally looking for a generalist. A lot of those you might ask for a referral from a friend or something like that. But when it goes a little bit deeper, chances are you're going to go online. And that's where kind of I was like, okay, we need to make this change. And if I was an advisor today, if unless you know from the beginning what your specialty is going to be, or if there's a group of individuals you do enjoy working with, start off with that. You can always change it later on. It doesn't mean it's set in stone, but just starting off as kind of a generalist is very tough in this environment.
So there's something that strikes me about your rebranding and your constant efforts at reinvention There's something in psychology called the fresh start effect, where people are more likely to do something big on New Year's Day or on their 40th birthday or their 50th birthday. When you look at people doing things like running marathons or climbing a high mountain peak or something like that, it clusters around milestone birthdays, right? Nobody's doing this when they turn 42. They're doing it when they turn 40, right? Yeah. And so we can look for ways to generate a fresh start, right? We don't have to wait for New Year's. We don't have to wait for that milestone birthday. If you just say, look, I may not be able to start my business again, but this is my fresh start. Let's have this period of reinvention. You can look at your business with new eyes and do what you should have done 20 years ago with the benefit of 25 years of knowledge.
Right, yeah. It's a constant auditing of the firm and trying to figure out how we can improve. It does drive my team crazy sometimes because they feel like I just never want to sit down, right? But it's motivating to me. I like learning, and just even like you going to the conferences, talking to our colleagues, learning from other professionals in the industry. So it's constantly moving. You can't stand still in this environment.
Yeah. So you're someone I think of as a bit of a futurist in this space, and someone who has his finger on the pulse of where things are headed. You know, you've been in the business 25 years. When you cast your vision forward 25 years, you're maybe retiring. Where do you
hopefully
think,
sooner than that?
Yeah, well, I look, man, I figured you love your work. You're going to have a good long run.
No, it's, yeah.
So whenever that is, 25 years from now, 20 years from now, where do you think we are and how different does the business look then?
It's interesting because there could be something coming out from left field that you and I would never have seen, and that could just totally disrupt the industry, right? You know, we've heard a lot of people talking about, well, what if Amazon Prime decides to now include asset management, or they create their own robo? How many people would go there for $10 a month and just say, sure, why not? You know, so something like that, I think, is on the horizon. I don't know when it will be. Obviously, there's a lot of regulatory issues and reason why Microsoft and Apple and others have not jumped into the financial industry. But that being said, there's going to be a lot bigger changes, just like we've seen, you know, going back to the early 90s of how information flowed from one direction to the other. That has changed, definitely. We've also seen investments change, right? What we were talking about, initially we were talking about mutual funds. Oh my, the Putnam Fund from 1920, blah, blah, blah. No one's talking about that stuff anymore, at least not the advisors that I really know about. And things have now switched to individual positions, to ETFs, to now we're talking about direct indexing, so a lot of other types of stuff. So the industry will continue to evolve and change. But one thing that I am noticing is, especially when you look through, let's say, the banking channels and others, they're slowly but surely trying to, for lack of a better word, try to remove the sales force, right? They're trying to figure out how can we not have as many assets under the advisors. So, giving you an example, we won't name names, but a firm will come in and say, okay, it's 2022, we're going to now raise the minimum. So if any client account below X dollars is now has to be a house account or has to move into our robo solution or hybrid solution or whatever it is. So you're gonna see more and more of that till they eventually a lot of those advisors have to go somewhere else. That's where I see happening. And then slowly, hopefully, if we can get a lot of these fintech companies to come around developing on advice. The problem today is advice is, it's hard. It's not scalable, right? So it's easy for me as an advisor to charge on assets and fees because it's easy to scale in that manner for the most part if you're doing the right things and bringing the value. But if you're not and you're trying to do financial plans that might take 8 to 10 hours for each client, it's hard to do that. You have to constantly be probably bringing in other CFPs and building that out. Hopefully that evolves to a point where that's a lot more turnkey and a lot of that could be done on the level as clients get onboarded and that information is not just, okay, we put your information on the plan and it's done, but it's adaptive and it's learning. The AI is where I think is going to change us in the future. So it might be a little bit scary, but imagine something saying, hey, Daniel, yeah, you spent X amount, this affected your budget. Just, you know, don't spend $50 on lunch next time or whatever it is, right? So those types of things where the system is learning what you do can help you in encouraging you. Right now we have, I don't want to call it these little chachi things, but we have all these apps that will round up and deposit 42 cents into your bank account or in your investment account. I don't know what that really amounts to, especially after you're paying fees to those things, to those companies and apps. But if we can have the AI develop, I think we're definitely going to go to an industry to a point where asset management is not going to be that much of a focus. A lot of stuff will be working through direct indexing and other variables, and advice is going to be very important, and trying to figure out how to scale that is what's going to be crucial for firms.
Yeah, I get so excited about the personalization elements of AI, and I think we've moved from, you know, from product and performance now to planning, and I think the next one is personalization, and that AI that you're talking about is going to drive that.
Yeah, it has to because right now there's a lot of the stuff, even as an advisor, if I have you link your accounts and so forth, there's only so much I can see. But the AI is going to pick on activity, on habits. Just think about someone like that's wearing the Apple Watch or smartwatch or the Aura Ring or whatever. Constant data going in, and I could tell if, oh, you're having breathing issues, mm-hmm. or you need to get up and walk around, or you need to do that. So instilling some of that, those habits, the good habits, into something AI, which talks about financial stuff, I think can help people and kind of mold them to the right thing. But we got to make sure that they understand what they're doing too, and not just using the bad with it, right? So hopefully the AI will push them in the right direction, and then that could be something that's given back to us. Just like if we go back to that doctor example, you know, if they put like a device on you and say, we're going to record all the things you do for a month, come back in a month and we're going to dissect that.
Yeah.
So think about if that was something where for 6 months we see what's happening and the AI dissects it and then gives it to us as a planner and says, hey, these are the top five things you should probably be discussing with your client.
Yeah. It's incredible to think about. My father-in-law just had his life saved by his Apple Watch. He had a hard fall skiing, and it alerted, you know, the relevant folks, and they were able to call the ski patrol, and he was off, you know, doing some wild whatever. I don't ski. Listen, man, I'm from Alabama, but like, you know,
they don't have snow there.
Yeah, no snow in Alabama. But like some double black diamond craziness or whatever, had a hard fall. And his Apple Watch alerted people. I think those just-in-time alerts are coming for finance.
Even to have someone maybe second-guess something, if the AI is like, you sure you really want to buy that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe you should think twice, or let's put this purchase on pause for a week. Let's revisit it and come back and see what you think. And I do that to this day personally, but we have to do that, you know, on a manual basis of saying, okay, I want that shiny little tech object that just came out. And I'm like, and I said, no, I'm not going to order it. I'm going to wait. And a week later, I'm like, I don't really need it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that type of stuff.
So last question's a little personal. You've been at it for 25 years. You've changed a lot of lives in that time. And I think we as an industry often highlight those stories of how we advisors have done great things for the people we serve. But inevitably, I think that should be a reciprocal thing, and that you should be growing and improving and changing as you learn from and grow with your clients. How are you different today, and how have your clients changed you for the better?
Yeah, my clients have changed me so much. I mean, I would say, obviously, when I started, I was 21 years old, and the big thing for me was trying to be wealthy and make a lot of money and start a family and so forth, and focusing a lot more on the dollar than the balance in life and so forth. And I'm still kind of guilty to that, but I've tried to make a big difference and change in balancing that. And a lot of our clients have shown me that that money doesn't really mean a lot, especially those in the 25 years that have passed on. You know, they worked so hard. I saw some of them that were, you know, they work so hard in growing their assets, but then they never actually got a chance to enjoy it.
Right.
Right. So, and then we have the opposite where they grew their assets and then they're blowing through it at a speed where you're like, you're going to run out of money. Mm-hmm. And then finding that balance is important. Right before I came to record this, we just had a meeting with one of our favorite clients, husband and wife. They're in their 80s. We just met with their kids, their estate planning attorney, their successor trustee, and all this. It was, we literally sat around the dinner table and just had a dialogue and figuring things out. And that was beautiful to me, because the family wanted to make sure that the next generation and what the legacy they're leaving behind is going to be known. So I've learned a lot in that regards. I've learned that we need to make sure we have that balance and we're not constantly chasing things that you know, it's just, it's like the sun, you know, it's always going down. I could keep running after, but it's just going to keep going. So making sure we work on having the goals in mind for our firm and building that out. The beauty with the clients is the fact that they just have given me a better understanding of what life really means, and you know, seeing them actually go through retirement helped me see what my retirement could possibly look like and changes I would want to make and before I get there, not working till, you know, the point where I'm not healthy enough to enjoy. And so forth. And then also the family interactions and making sure, for a lot of our clients, it's important that the next generation understands money, right? We're talking about financial literacy earlier. And now that's something that I've instilled in my kids, in understanding what they need to do, what the dollar means, what the money means, how to save it, how to spend it, and so forth. So they've had a vast effect on me, and there's no way for me, I'm having a hard time even just explaining it, but yeah. It's definitely amazing to see that, because I've seen different lives and different generations of clients at this point.
Yeah. I mean, the average person has one financial life, right? You know, most of us who don't work in finance move through the world, and our experience of money is our experience of money, and that's all we know. But I think advisors, and even people like me who work with advisors, we get to see 100 stories play out simultaneously. Yeah. Yeah. And learn from the good and the bad.
Yeah, even the bad part is something that's been helpful too, right? So one of the things I discussed with the clients earlier today is, like, they have a real estate. And, you know, one of the things we've noticed is when the clients pass, we get, whether it be the children or whoever is going to inherit the wealth, finding over typically assets like real estate and so forth. Like, one might say, oh, I want to sell it, I need the money. And the other one might say, oh, let's just rent it out, or I'm going to have little Timmy move in and so forth. And then that just causes a lot of problems. So that has helped me in kind of formulating my own finances mm-hmm. and decisions. Not only that, but having that conversation with my kids. If today something were to happen to me after we record this podcast, they know what needs to be done. They know how we're going to take care of the family and so forth. So just creating succession plans. And it's amazing. When we talk about advisors, we were talking to our clients about beneficiaries and succession plans, yet what percentage of them, most of them, don't have a succession plan set up. So it's kind of ironic. But I've learned and I've tried to incorporate a lot of that into my own life.
Good. Well, Alex, congrats again on the recent top 10 recognition. I think anyone that's listened to this podcast and has experienced the depth of your experience and your knowledge knows just where that came from. If people want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about FutureVest, where can we find you?
Yeah, so for FutureVest, the best thing is to go to our website, futurevest.com, FutureVest.com. You can find me, like Daniel, on Twitter, possibly. My handle is at Alex Chalakian. And for Lake Avenue Financial, you just go to lakeavenuefinancial.com.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.